I've been told that we're on a strict time limit. We have to be out of here by 6:30, so I'm launching into things in a martial fashion. I'd just like to introduce Stephen Shapiro, who is giving our next plenary. Stephen is based here at Warwick and has been an integral part of the Warwick Research Collective on World Lit. His own background was as an Americanist. What I was going to say is you have also moved outwards. You are still an Americanist and focusing on the writing and culture of the United States, particularly the pre-20th century period, and his fantastic monograph, The Culture and Commerce of the Early American Novel, Reading the Atlantic World System, is an incredibly useful demonstration of how world systemic literary criticism can illuminate our understanding of forms and genres in relation to terms like core, periphery, semi-periphery, which I think he's going to be kind of expanding on today. So I recommend that you check it out if you want to kind of look at these things in more depth. He's also written on cultural studies, literary theory, Marxism and urban and spatial studies, the sociology of religion. His workshop that he's running here is on television studies, and he's had numerous books come out on Marx, on Foucault, on The Wire, as well as editions such as Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, A Critical Translation of the Productive Body, and he's currently working on two new book studies, A Cultural Study of Social Panics and Religious Energies, tentatively titled From Gothic to God, Paranormal Capitalism in Evangelical America, and The Anti-Capitalist Foucault. And he also, I would like to put in a plug for his article on Gothic periodicity, which if you're interested in Gothic and genre and the kind of question of periodicity that I think he's going to also touch on today, Transvaal, Transylvania, is an absolutely kind of condensed, very useful way of kind of beginning to think about periodicity rather than periodization of genres. Anyway, I will stop talking and let you do your thing. 45 minutes, go.
You know, if any of you are watching Masters of Sex, which is a Showtime show about the sex studies of Bill Masters and Virginia Johnson, at the end of the first season, Bill Masters is about to give a presentation of his research, which he thinks will make his career, and it actually momentarily destroys it. And his co-worker, collaborator, Virginia Johnson, who's not working with him at this moment, she says, "Oh, please don't let Bill start off with methodology. He always likes starting about methodology." And for people who know me, that is my interest as well. And so what I thought I would do is start out by giving a slight manifesto statement, then talk about terminology, and then end by telling a story about the early American novel of the 18th century, which is, for better or for worse, my service scholarship. I've spent much of my career in that field. Okay. So I'd like to welcome you today to this to the school with this with a warning. There's no going back. The familiar models of organizing literary and cultural studies by language group, period, genre, nationality, and traits of aesthetic genius are in a terminal crisis of obsolescence. Thomas Kuhn argued that when a discipline's paradigms of theoretical knowledge production break apart, they break apart when the conceptual frameworks can no longer coherently explain its evidence. I would claim that literary and cultural studies in the 21st century now faces also such a bifurcation that it's in a paradigm crisis. The old ones simply no longer work. They're no longer fit for purpose, partly as a result of three interlinking trends. The legacy of post-war British cultural studies and history from the bottom up has dramatically expanded the social context and comparative evidentiary matter of literary studies beyond a highly selective tradition of canonical works. And this is an event that undermines aesthetic value-based categories and helps refuse to differentiate between the literary and the sub or paraliterary on the other side. So the high-low culture has been blasted. Digitalization has furthered this trend as the readily available archive has exponentially expanded far beyond the human capacity of individual researchers. Information overload has hit the humanities. This is big data. Finally, post-colonialism has critiqued the parameters of Anglophone and comparative literary studies as complicit with Euro-American domination that implicitly rests on racializing distinction. The traditional model of comparative literary studies, as developed in the post-war period, particularly in the U.S. Academy, that is to say, involving Latin, Greek, and the European languages, is also suffering, on the one hand, from the increasing hegemony of English as a world language, helped or hurt by the erosion of foreign language knowledge among contemporary students, and on the other, questions about why that model excluded other tongues such as Farsi, Cantonese, Chinese, Hindi, Swahili, to name but a few. I guess emoji would be the last one on that list. As many of you know, there's the emoji Moby Dick, right? Translation project. The dominant models of post-war literary studies are simply no longer tenable. Furthermore, the linguistic turn of high theory during the last quarter of the 20th century was a compensatory gesture that delayed but could not remove the intrinsic crisis in comparative literary studies. Another way of thinking about this is intertwines this, the rise of theory with the unwitting rise of neoliberalism in the early 1970s. Joshua Clover has talked about this. An ensuing corollary is that we need to explore new models for literary studies. And in this talk, I will try to introduce one such attempt, the question of conceptualizing texts in a global frame, oftentimes known as the world literature debate, and a turn to world systems perspectives, which is my own. As critics have moved away from the linguistic nation as a classificatory device for cultural production, there has been a desire to consider global relations and a renewed interest in area studies, like Atlanticism, as a better model. Yet this turn, oftentimes called the spatial term, I would argue still operates mainly at the rhetorical level, as it lacks a methodology and logic of ordering material. One solution to this problem would be the world systems approach that sees the rise of historical capitalism as a network of competing players trying to gain power through control of international and domestic factions. Because this model originates from a loose collective of economic historians, political scientists, and large structure sociologists, the exact relations, though, between literary culture and the history of global formations remains in need of theorization. That's your job. Get busy. So in one way, this vacation school's role is to provide you with a toolbox, to familiarize you as future cultural researchers with certain terminology, claims, and points of difference in the debate surrounding world systems, so you can enter into the ongoing debate about world literature as a new paradigm for 21st century literary and cultural studies. But before you, as literary and cultural studies scholars, can deploy this new perspective, you need to become familiar with a set of interdisciplinary arguments and considerations, a few of which I'll just try and sketch out today. So I want to talk about some terms, principles, and possible directions to encourage you to consider a world systems perspective for world literature. And when I say world literature, I mean that with a hyphen, world hyphen literature, for reasons I may explain later on. So what is world systems? World systems is an approach of historical sociology and political science, mainly associated with the work of Emmanuel Wallerstein and others like Giovanni Arrighi and Terrace Hopkins while they were at SUNY Binghamton's Ferdinand Braudel Center. Other people involved in it are Walter Goldfrank, now emeritus at University of California, Santa Cruz, and Christopher Chase Dunn, still in the history department at UC Riverside. One shorthand might be to see it as the fusion of Braudelian long-duration historiography with critiques of Eurocentric developmental theory. Weighted towards the disciplines of history, political science, and sociology, world systems approaches, though, have not yet had widespread applications for cultural, literary, lens media, or informatic studies. A few passages from Frederick Jameson, perhaps my 2008 book, The Culture and Commerce of the Early American Novel, Reading the Atlantic World System, And now, mainly through Franco Moretti's invocation of it through the emerging field of world literature. And I would argue, and I'm not going to go into this in further this talk, but I would say that while Moretti invokes world systems, he does not actually deploy it, which is one of the paradoxes of those pieces. He sort of names it, but then he doesn't actually instrumentalize it in his readings of it. And then, of course, there's this forthcoming work from the Warwick Research Collective, REC, many of whom will be speaking today, Nick Lawrence, Sorsha, Sheree, Neil Lazarus, and so on. This fabled project, which took many far longer than it should have, but apparently will be in your hands by next year, the goddess willing. Before I sketch a pathway today, though, let me first insist that world systems approaches do not have a method so much as they are a perspective. It's an optic about ways of understanding historical capitalism over wide units of time and space. World systems uses a hyphen between world and system to indicate the relationality of social geography within capitalism. It is not interested in a universalizing world or abstract planetary galactic field, to use the language from Y.G. Dimmock or Gayatri Spivak, but instead is solely interested in a constructed or built geography contoured by historical capitalism. That's to say, if you're not particularly interested in the ways that capitalism shapes social relations, that's fine, I guess. But if you're not interested in this, I have to warn you that world systems is not going to be of much use to you, partly because a good basic knowledge of Marx is taken as implicit and axiomatic in world systems approaches. They do not add anything about the economy of capitalism. They really pretty much take Marx or a commonsensical understanding of Capital, the three volumes of Capital as read. Furthermore, world systems is not a commentary on pre- or weakly modern empires, where the modern is loosely the advent of capitalism on a larger scale from the late 15th century. So it's not interested in universalized history. It's solely interested in historical capitalism, starting slowly and in pockets from the 15th century and building up to the Godzilla of today. Unlike a centralized world empire, a world system exists as an interstate system. It's not a center, but it's a collection of centers. That's what's meant by interstate system. So you might think of this as an analog, the Russell Group of universities, right? There's a kind of world system to that. In other words, it's competition among a center of cores. Maybe some of you are not from the British Academy, so that doesn't make any sense. But it's an elite. It's an elite title.
Ivy League.
It's like the Ivy League.
The Ivy League isn't what the Ivy is. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, you know what I mean. That's to say, it's an interstate system. It's a shared economic and sociocultural space dominated by capitalist drives where groups of nation states conjoined in relations of competition and cohabitation gain preeminence based on their ability to manage domestic class conflicts and international division of labor through core, semi-periphery, and periphery divisions. The world system is a space within the world. It is a space formed by unequal relations amongst the core, semi-periphery, and periphery, or to use Franco Moretti's phrase, it is one and unequal. Or to use Frederick Jameson's, it's a singular modernity. It's a unit. It's a unit of analysis. Unlike structuralist or post-structuralist comparative literature, the emphasis is on inequality rather than difference, different set of keywords, or differences associated terms like hybridity, intersectionality, cyborgism, and so on. The core should really be called a core zone, since it's analogous to the term middle class, which refers to a set of elites who compete against each other, even as they collectively antagonize outsiders. Core regions consist of strong nation states that define the traffic in goods and commodify labor power to their advantage, while the periphery includes weak or non-centralized state regions that are violently seized for the natural resources of the terrain, strategic location, and labor of their peoples. So while the nation-state remains a unit of analysis, it is not self-contained. While there are moments in the world system where one nation is clearly dominant, it is actually more often the case that there is a tension between different core nations that plays out. Right? We oftentimes think of like the American century, but actually the world system is usually formed by competitive tensions rather than monolithic hegemonies. And so, for instance, in an article on Dracula, which Sheree mentioned, I consider Anglo-German tensions in the late 19th century over who will be the leading world power as a key motivation for that. So I read Dracula as a kind of extended response to the Boer War, in a sense. Hence the phrase Transvaal, Transylvania. Furthermore, the difference between the periphery and the core should not be conceptualized as simply between static boundaries, since these terms represent spatialized relations more than geographic demarcations. Each spatial level, area, national, regional, urban, familial, contains its own core periphery distances. Individual nation states have their own internal core-like and peripheral zones, north-south or urban agrarian divisions, and they often have a city system where some cities dominate on others. So, for instance, the talk about London as being centric, right, which is a very key motivation in this week's independence election in Scotland, where it's actually much more concerned about London than England. It's actually, the debate's not really driven by England. Cities, too, though, have their own Manchester effect, referring to Engels' book, of class-differentiated regions, such as the core sectors where elites live and work, and the peripheral slums housing the manual labor force. The patriarchal family or racialized society can also be conceptualized as having white men as its core and women and non-whites as their semi-peripheral or peripheral actors. The key point is none of these levels is either wholly independent of the others or mechanistically determined by them. It is not a fixed structure. Each one of these levels has its own particular shape, which means that each one of them is both particular and universal, systemic and somewhat unusual based on the particular configuration. And scientists will say the exact same thing about DNA, right? In popular sense, that everyone uses the, like my university, there's a lot of language the university describes as having a DNA, as though DNA is just like a fixed static shape. But any, you know, undergraduate science major will remind you that DNA exists in a multispatial environment, right? That there's a sort of interrelational level. So that's to say these levels often intersect with each other in unpredictable ways because the relations of one level are not necessarily analogous or contiguous to each other. So for instance, this is one reason why I prefer the phrase valences rather than scales, because scales to me still has a structuralist interpretation, whereas valences has the sort of echo of electron theory, where electrons can jump up and down between the valences. The key point, though, is to, regardless of what keyword we use, due to these manifold geometries of unequal exchange and power relations, Christopher Chase Dunn urges us that we think of logistical boundaries rather than spatial ones. There's a logistic, not a logic, but a logistic, general tendencies that have a kind of weight and drive through. And that furthermore, we imagine the divisions as involving relations that cannot easily be mapped on a two or even three-dimensional surfaces, even while the nation-state form provides a momentary, useful cognitive map of these differences. So for instance, the sort of Bourdieuian field model, where you've got this sort of rectangular, I think very poorly works for a world systems model. Then, of course, there is the semi-periphery, which Wallerstein describes as zones that are clearly in between the core periphery structure in that they house within their borders both peripheral processes in relation to core states and core-like processes in relation to adjacent peripheral states. The semi-periphery can be thought of as the states that are in the minor leagues, hoping to become core players, but also fearing relegation to the periphery. semi-peripheral agents, analogous to the terms domestic petit or petit bourgeoisie or foreign comprador bourgeoisie, often seek to maintain their privilege by acting as the buffering junior managerial region that gets its hands dirty by administering core logistics on peripheral regions and protecting the core from directly receiving the force of peripheral acts of resistance and revenge. So in this sense, Itamar Evan Zohar's notion of binary influence when it's going to a cultural model, where he argues a host nation interferes with a peripheral one, that might not be that useful a model because it's too binary. It's got just core and periphery. It doesn't have a sense of the semi-periphery or all the mediating forms in which power relations may take place on the global language. It's a language that is simply not supple enough to account for the actualities of the world system, the semi-peripheries and their agents. For example, one of the semi-peripheries' roles is the geocultural calibration of the world system. Because the social action of the core region is too incommensurate with that of the periphery, the world system requires a calibrating zone that can mediate and translate the cultural and commodity economies of each sphere to one another. The semi-periphery receives, monetarizes, and forwards two kinds of commodities. On one hand, the core's fictional ones of credit, insurance, and contractual property and intellectual rights, and on the other, the periphery's labor power and natural resources. But those two can't, as it were, face one another directly. They need a mediating form, something much like the money form in Marx's argument about the relationship between two different kinds of commodities. As the transistor space where two different segments of a commodity chain become articulated and receive their first pricing or cultural evaluation, the semi-periphery is the contact zone that makes it possible for the core and the periphery to transmit value to each other, especially as both the rural dispossessed of the hinterlands and the factors of the core's jobbing interests often congregate there. So, for instance, you might want to think about the Western genre or the bar scene, right? Star Wars, for instance. You've got these, that model of the core and the periphery coming together in this sort of entrepreneur or informal marketplace. That's a good, kind of good scenification or visualization of what I'm trying to describe here. The core periphery is where the rural dispossessed and the jobbing interests come together, one to commodify their labor and the other to finance and ensure the material apparatuses that will consume this labor power. As the zone where political economy thus receives its greatest cultural inflection and amplification, the semi-peripheries are the sites where the experience of trauma by peripheral peoples and the speculative entrepreneurship of the core collide to produce new forms of representation, especially as it receives both the oral folk beliefs of the periphery and the core's printed matter and institutionally consecrated objects, texts, and behavioral performances. So let me just pause for a moment. I realize this was the sort of the methodology which I warned you about. Let me pause to suggest the semi-peripheral might be a way to reconceptualize the high-low culture split. And we might want to think about pulp or genre texts as semi-peripheral mediums, neither folk nor consecrated culture, but in between. Neither the sort of the stories that a child might have heard sitting around the campfire, nor the sort of the high literature of the elite marketplace, but an in-between site. And that's why they're extremely generative. Doing so would complicate, I think, the Bourdieuian model of the field of culture in ways very similar to Rancière's critique of Bourdieu. That is to say, when we use the Bourdieuian model, the very visual nature of the square misdirects or forces our attention to the squares. It misdirects us away from the more clearly defined corners, away from the blurred muddle of the middle, which can't easily be named in that Bourdieuian model. Rancière's point, this is early Rancière, is that is precisely where emergent forms of culture take place. But it's difficult because we do not yet have a syntax of classification or categorization for that. This is one reason why the university is always belated to actual social experience. because the university, as a structure of classification, is more comfortable with the outlines of the square rather than the turbulence of the middle. Okay, so hold this point in mind. Let me say something about time. Mainly I was talking about space, not a time. Guided by Marx's axioms on the cyclicality of capitalism's political economy, a world systems analysis explains how political cartography is contoured by the rise and fall of roughly 50-year-long long waves due to the intrinsic contradictions of the business cycle. Nation states, or more precisely, dominant fractions,